History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Those stories really don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We aim to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. In the process, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. And maybe this is a Captain Obvious statement for some of you, but some of the best places to encounter veterans are military museums. So many of the volunteers there are men and women who have served, and over the last couple decades, we've met quite a few of them at museums from coast to coast. This time of year, Palm Springs, California is a pretty popular destination. For example, it's 65 degrees and sunny there this weekend. The next time you're headed to Palm Springs to get away or to watch some of the best tennis players in the world or the top golfers, you can also soak in a little history and browse an impressive array of aircraft at the Palm Springs Air Museum. There's something for everybody, from so many historic World War II planes to the F-117 Nighthawk stealth fighter, and even the Dark Star, the futuristic plane piloted by Tom Cruise's character in Top Gun Maverick. You won't want to miss out on the gift shop either, but adding to all the exhibits are the stories of the volunteers who represent living history. And we're going to hear from some of them today, including a soon-to-be centenarian who carries around a pocket full of nickels. Maybe you can imagine why. You'll hear it straight from him later. But the first veteran I got to visit with was stationed in front of the B-17 that was used in the 1990 film Memphis Belle. 89-year-old Daryl Mulvihill once managed Catalina Airlines. He has volunteered at the museum for the last 12 years. And I asked him what got him started.
It was another good friend of mine who is no longer here, but he's the one that asked me. I had a house up in Big Bear Lake for a number of years, and I came down here one day, and he took me here, and when I went through the whole area for a couple of hours, 3 hours with him, I wanted to be part of it.
And I'm sure you've been to other air museums and other museums in general. What do you think makes this place special?
Well, in my opinion, how large it is, and you have so much to choose and look for, in my opinion now. And it goes back into the history, too, because there are museums, as you said, that have airplanes, but a lot of them are not some of the older airplanes, you know, World War II, Korea, and stuff like that. But I've enjoyed it. And then Fred, who's our manager, and he's just been a fabulous person, just a wonderful guy, and he has put this together. It was he needed a lot of work done when he took it over. Believe me, he did, and he knew it too. I'm not saying anything that's out of the ordinary.
Do you have some favorite exhibits or planes that are here?
Well, I like this hangar, and I like all the hangars, but actually I like this hangar because of the individual single pilot. Except for the bomber we have here behind us. I just enjoy that very much because, as I said before, these are planes of yesterday. And they're going to be building another hangar, it's my understanding, within a couple of months. That means more airplanes will be parked down there or whatever, you know.
I bet you've met some interesting people out here.
I have. I really have. And the gentlemen that are here, they've all had a background of some kind, and I can't begin to tell you all the different people and what organization they've been part of, but they're nice people, very nice and very friendly people, no problems whatsoever.
What about your own military story? What branch were you in?
I was in the Marine Corps for 4 years, and that was back in 1956 through 1960. I did not because I didn't want to, but I didn't go to any war of any kind, but I became a military police 2.5 years, my last 4 years, and learned a lot from that. I was stationed in San Diego. Now, don't tell anybody this, but I was stationed next to a Navy base. And back in those days, there was a lot of, let's just say, different opinions, I'll put it that way, you know, stuff like that, which is understandable.
You mean as to
Who was tougher, a Marine or a sailor?
Well, they didn't want to hear about what we've done. It wasn't just Daryl, it was other Marines that were talking about what they either were already in Korea and come back or whatever. And some of the sailors didn't want to hear about it and stuff like that. Not all of them, but just some, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just like anything up here even right now. You know, there's one person who doesn't want to hear about anything and couldn't care less, and, you know. But we have a lot of good people here that work here full-time. I'm not full-time. I'm 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. But I enjoy it very, very much, as I said. I really do.
I bet you get people from all over the world.
You know, we really do, more than people realize. That's a good question. People are from all over the United States, obviously, and some people, there was a couple here from yesterday from London. Different people over the time are different countries sometimes, and they're here for most of the time, 2, 3, 4 weeks, depends on situation. Personally speaking, I think it's a very interesting, and with Fred being the manager, he knows how to keep this thing alive and keep it going, and he's one of these guys that he gets up and does things. He's not a behind the desk and, well, go do this and then walk away. With all due respect, he's a good gentleman, really is.
Well, I got two more questions for you. I've heard once a Marine, always a Marine, but yeah. What did your years in the Marine Corps do for you in terms of the rest of your life and how you've gone about it?
Well, be very honest with you. I lost my father and my mother in a traffic accident in my last year in high school. And I was by myself, and I was pretty angry and scared at the same time. And it took me a while. And some of my friends who don't live anymore, they brought me into their house, helped me out, and encouraged me to get into the military. And they said they would prefer me to get in the Marine Corps, because back there it was a little stricter, I'll put it that way. And I did. And it helped me a lot, you know, because I lost everybody. I was by myself stuff at a small age of 16, you know. But it worked out, and I'm really proud of it. Always have been, and listen to other people who've been in the Marine Corps, even here when I sit here or talk to other people. Some have been there 5 years ago, some have been there 30 years ago, you know. It just depends. It's a good organization. Oh, they're all good organizations. Believe me, they are. They are.
And if someone hears this and they're going to come to the Palm Springs Air Museum, but they're only allowed to go look at one plane, what's the one plane or aircraft that they absolutely have to see?
Probably the B-17 hangar in the next hangar over there. And they can take a tour through that airplane. And it's the B-17 also, but you can't take a tour through there.
Can't go inside the Memphis Belle, but in the B-17 hangar, you can actually walk inside.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Have you imagined yourself in any of those positions on a bomber crew?
No, I haven't. I'll be honest with you. I listened to a lot of people who were either there or almost there, and I was happy with what I went through. I got lucky. I'll put it that way. I didn't end up in Korea or anything like that. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. They just chose different people, and that was it. Be very candid with you.
Well, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling me a little bit about what you do here. Is there anything else you think we need to know?
I don't think so. I think if you're going to do what you're going to do, there's a lot of nice people all in different hangars, too,
yeah,
who have great backgrounds also. Just take your time, and each hangar, I think, is very interesting.
Thanks again to Daryl Mulvihill. The Palm Springs Air Museum opened with one hangar and 14 aircraft in 1996. These days, there are 5 hangars and over 70 aircraft. The Pacific Hangar is where I encountered Mike Stone, who's been volunteering there for 8 years. What was it that hooked you?
The PBY, actually. I stopped by one day to check out the museum for the first time and saw that airplane, and next thing you know, I'm volunteering.
Because that particular airplane stirred some memories for you?
Yes, it does, very much so. In all honesty, as far as military aircraft go, the PBY is my favorite. Absolute favorite.
Well, tell us why. You've got a family connection there.
Yes, I do. My father flew PBYs during the Second World War. He was at Pearl Harbor when they got attacked. Wow. And I wound up with his logbooks after he passed and found out where he actually was during the Second World War, all over the Pacific, doing things that I'm surprised he survived with a PBY.
Where was he on December 7th?
Pearl Harbor.
I mean, was he at Pearl or like Kaneohe or one of the?
At Pearl. Wow. They just came off their the Curtis, which was their repair ship, if you want to call it that. And they'd just come ashore when they were attacked.
I've interviewed some guys from the Curtis. And did he tell you much about that day and what he experienced?
Not a lot, other than it scared the hell out of all of them. And as they got off the landing craft, they were heading for their aircraft when it took a bomb, direct hit. And they said everybody just grabbed what they could and started shooting. Then they went and changed their shorts.
And that was just the first day of the war, and you said there were a lot of situations that you're surprised he survived. Was there a memory that he shared with you that you often think of and makes you examine your own existence differently? Because I'm guessing you wouldn't have been born if he didn't survive that.
You're right, I wouldn't be here. The one that actually sticks in my mind, and it is a fact, I mean, it's documented, they were on a patrol, and as they came out of a cloud formation, losing a little altitude, off to their starboard side was a Japanese Mavis seaplane. And they got into a gunfight. Two seaplanes in a gunfight. The Mavis lost.
Yeah, that's not the way they draw battles up, is it?
No. And if you think about it, two seaplanes in a dogfight, that's funny. But yeah, they got through it. They took some hits. They actually lost the airplane when they got back in. And when they landed, it had so many holes in it, it sank. But nobody on their aircraft got hurt. That's the one that sticks in my mind.
I can see why. And you served in a different branch. Why not the Navy?
I was going to join the Navy, but I had an accident surfing. And the Navy said they couldn't touch me for a year. In the meantime, the Army got me. I mean, I broke my neck showing off for some girl from New York. You see, I didn't end up going in the Navy. I actually moved from California to Mississippi to work on the Saturn Apollo project. And while I was down in Mississippi, that's when Uncle Sam said, "Come on, we want you." So I didn't argue. I went along, played the game, and wound up in the Army. Didn't go to Vietnam, fortunately. And they decided to send me to Germany to fix aircraft that needed work on them.
Well, you said a couple things there that I need to circle back and ask you about. First, did you say you broke your neck?
I broke my neck, yes. Showing off for some girl from New York who was a friend of my stepmother's. Manhattan Beach.
Well, you say that like that's no big deal. I mean, that could have been life-altering.
It actually was life-altering because I had to change things I was doing. I was really being stupid at 17 years old. But I got through it, and I survived. And, life goes on.
And then you said you worked on the Saturn and Apollo project. What were you doing for that?
I wound up working for General Electric in what they called the reproduction department. Anytime there was an operation, like firing off one of the stages or anything that was going on, everything was brought in on computers, and we would document it. Print out all the information and get the information out to people who needed it. Being there and actually seeing what was going on and having an understanding of it, I was impressed. I wouldn't really talk about it much, but I had a little involvement with putting a man on the moon, which is a little bit of pride for me.
You ever get a chance to mention that to people coming through here at the Palm Springs Air Museum?
On occasion. I have, in the last 8 years, met two people who actually worked at the test site where I was. One of them was North American, another one was Boeing.
Well, it's a small world. Your time in the Army, they sent you to Germany. What'd you get to do?
Well, as a machinist, I thought I was going into a trucking company, but it turned out to be an aviation. We did move things, but everything we moved was by air. It was a 591st transportation company, Air Mobile. I became the head machinist. So what I would end up doing is manufacturing parts for aircraft, fixed wing and helicopter, or I would take a part that wasn't quite finished and finish it off, get it to the mechanics that needed to do the work, and then I'd have to go back and double check their work before we could sign off on it and put them back in the air. Once the aircraft was ready to go, we would send it out to the company that actually had the aircraft Force when it needed it, and it was good. I actually enjoyed it.
And did any of that experience translate to post-Army life?
No, it didn't. I stayed in the machine shop part-time because I had a family and raising kids, and we all know how that goes. You need a little extra money. My career was in graphic arts, running printing presses. It was good. I hated it for 43 years.
Well, it sure seems like you love what you do here at the Air Museum. Why should someone come to the Palm Springs Air Museum?
Want to learn a little history? This museum is full of it, primarily World War II and Korea, Vietnam. We do have some new displays that are current, like the F-117 and the Dark Star from Lockheed. But my time here, this is the environment I grew up in with aviation. I blame my father for it. I did become a civilian pilot, general aviation. Never flew in the military other than as a passenger. And it's my background. Everybody says I have a lot of knowledge about aircraft. I think it's normal. But I enjoy meeting the people here. We get to share information, stories from them, stories from me, have a great time, and I love it. It's my passion. Aviation has always been my passion.
There is so much passion on display at the Palm Springs Air Museum, which features an open cockpit for a different plane every Saturday. Check it out online at palmspringsairmuseum.org, and we'll hear from more of the folks who bring it to life every day when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode recorded at the Palm Springs Air Museum in Palm Springs, California, where their annual gala is coming up on February 7th. Not only can you find some rare airplanes there, in some cases, you'll meet men who actually flew them, like 92-year-old Bob McCowan, who grew up in California's capital, Sacramento.
When you were growing up, did you have ideas of becoming a pilot someday?
Absolutely. Yeah. We lived right under the flight pattern of McClellan Air Force Base. So the airplanes flew over the house all the time. When I was 6 years old, I was watching them. So, absolutely.
What kind of planes were you watching when you were six?
P-38s, B-36s. McClellan was a material command base, and they all flew in there.
So you had the aviation bug early on?
I did, yes. And then I was going to get drafted in Korea my senior year in college. So I ran quick down to Oakland, took the test to get into Naval Flight School, and then went to Pensacola.
And I guess before that, if I'm doing that math, 92, so you're old enough to remember as a kid some of the World War II headlines and developments and what was happening. Were there some things that really got your attention in those years?
I remember way back when I was maybe 6 years old with my parents and grandparents sitting around a radio listening to this guy screaming in German. It was Hitler. And then the next thing that happened is my grammar school, all of a sudden after Pearl Harbor, doubled in size because the Air Force took all the families from Hawaii and sent them to McClellan.
Oh, wow.
So all of these kids were giving stories about watching all this, so it was kind of interesting and what was going on in Pearl Harbor raid.
Wow. You know, I've talked to so many people from that era. I haven't heard that story before. So all these people from Oahu are sent to Sacramento, and your new friends in school just lived through the craziest day in history.
They lived through the whole thing. It was really, yeah.
Was there a particular story any one of them told you that kind of stood out?
No, they were too young. You know, they were all second graders, third graders. Yeah.
So you're aware of military planes and all that then, and then you go into the Navy with the thought, I'm going to fly off some carriers?
That was the idea. Yeah. And in fact, I went through naval flight. It took a year, really, in basic training. And then when it came time to go to advanced training, if I'd stayed in the Navy, I would have been flying helicopters. And when you're a 22-year-old kid, you want to do something glamorous. And the Marine Corps guaranteed me that I would fly jet fighters. Mm-hmm. So I went in advanced training in the Panthers, the F-9, F-2, and got my wings in the Marine Corps.
I imagine here at the Palm Springs Air Museum, you run into a lot of people who've never heard of that aircraft before.
Yeah. I think I'm the last surviving person that flew it. In fact, I really made a major effort when we restored our Panther out here that we have on the line, that I got it painted up as a Marine airplane. So it is the only Marine one we have here in the fighter room.
Details matter. If you're the last one, then you're the only one who could tell us what it was like to fly that plane. What did you appreciate about that aircraft, and can you give us a sense of what some of your missions were like?
It was the Navy's first jet, and it was underpowered. You get up to 40,000 feet and it would barely keep flying. Actually, I never got to fly it in combat because by the time I got over there, the war had ended. So that really, but it was back in the fun days of dogfights. You know, I was stationed at El Toro at the time when I was flying the Panther. It was okay, but it was not anywhere as sprightly and quick as they are now. It was kind of a dog, really.
And I'm guessing maybe you went on to fly something else too?
Yeah, from there I went to fly the A-4s. And that's what I flew over most of the Orient. We were in A-4s. And it's called a scooter later, but we had never given it that name. That was something that came out of Vietnam. And it was an A-4. We have one out in the park, in the parking lot now.
So contrast that with the Panther in terms of the experience of flying it, maneuverability and all that.
Very, very agile, quick little airplane. And it would, if you got down low on fuel, it almost had as much power thrust as it weighed, so it could go really, it was very quick for its day. We didn't have an afterburner, but it was very maneuverable, and it was designed to drop the atom bomb, tactical atom bomb, and that's pretty much what we trained for.
Did you ever have to carry an actual one of those?
No, only the mock-ups. When we were in Japan, Japan did not allow any nuclear weapons on their property. So they would have had to bring a weapon on a carrier to Japan for us to take and go after the bad guys. But we never carried a real one.
And how long did you fly those, and give us a sense of what kind of situations you had in the A-4?
Well, I probably flew over every inch of South Korea at 100 feet. Wow. All of our missions were very low-level entry. Never touched down, never put my wheels down. So, I don't know, it was an interesting time. Only got shot at once when I was up in North Korea when I shouldn't have been. But that was, next day the Air Force guy got shot down, but I woke him up and he got, next day they shot him down.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was like 6:30 in the morning, so they weren't quite all up yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any close calls or situations that took your breath away in the A-4?
Yeah, I mean, you look back on it, there were many, many, many instances where it was quick ago, but I don't remember them all in detail. Things happen very fast. And it's we often reminisce in the fact that how many times we should have been killed, but we weren't.
How many years did you stay in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I got my wings in spring of 56, and I think I got out of active duty in January, September of 59, and I flew weekend warriors out of Los Alamitos for the next 3 or 4 years, and then I just gave it all up. Didn't have time.
What were you busy with?
The life of the corporate world and raising a family.
And how long have you been volunteering here at the museum?
Give or take, I think about 6, 7, 8 years, something like that.
Why do you do it? What do you get out of it?
I meet people from all over the world, which are fascinating. I actually met a woman on the arm of the daughter from the Philippines, and she worked at the officers' club when I was stationed there. Small world.
That's a really small world. If someone comes to visit the Palm Springs Air Museum, what's the number one plane or exhibit that they need to take some time with?
That's a good question. I think the one that's behind you, which is the Dauntless, which basically was key to really winning the war.
Because of Midway?
The Battle of Midway, yeah. That's probably the most interesting one, I think, yeah. And then on the other side, which I don't work on, would be the B-17. And, you know, they really had it rough in Europe compared to what we ran into in the Pacific. Yep.
Well, anything else I didn't ask you about you think I should know?
No, I think you've done it all.
Well, thank you for serving, and thank you for continuing to serve here at the museum.
Well, it's fun. It really is. It keeps me out of the house.
Maybe you'll get to meet Bob McCowan if you visit the Palm Springs Air Museum. If you pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find a short video there with Bob showing us some of his flight gear that's on display at the Palm Springs Air Museum. And you'll find another video with World War II veteran Pete Behenna, who continues to volunteer at the museum as he bears down on his 100th birthday in July. I started out by asking Pete about his childhood in Somerville, Massachusetts.
School years, playground, and ice skating in the winter, going to hockey games. And, well, I went to hockey games after the war. That was right. Okay, yeah. But I'm a hockey fan and everything like that from way back, yeah.
Who's your all-time favorite Bruin?
Bobby Orr. Milt Schmidt, Woody Dumont, Bobby Bauer, Ted Thompson, Frank Bremzik. Milt Schmidt was my most favorite one.
Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah.
Did you play a little hockey yourself?
No, I didn't. I didn't have a chance. Well, as a kid, I did. But after the war, I didn't play hockey at all, no. Mm-hmm. Too busy going to school and everything like that.
Do you remember before the war having some ideas of what you wanted to do when you grew up or what you wanted your life to look like?
Yeah, I actually wanted to be a pilot. And I remember as a six-year-old in the playground where I was at, this is about when I was probably 7 years old, I'd look up and I see this biplane flying below the clouds going by, and I'm sure it's a Navy airplane going to Squantum, Naval Air Station. But I also wanted, during the times, I wanted to be a Navy pilot off carriers. I read all the books on Navy airplanes and carrier-type airplanes in the 30s and everything like that, yeah. So that was my ambition. I had a scrapbook full of pictures of airplanes, and when the war started, like 1939, I remember a scrapbook getting pictures of airplanes and filling a scrapbook with all German, English, Canadian-type airplanes and everything like that, yeah.
So even before America was in the war, you were dialed into it?
Yes, I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Very much so, right.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Well, December 7th, I was at the movies in the afternoon. I was probably 15 at the time. Come home from the movies, my brother said to me, hey, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And I said, well, where's Pearl Harbor? I never knew anything about it. So one thing I learned about it. Then the next day, of course, I'm from a family of 13, and we all had chores in the house, 11 boys and 2 girls. And, of course, one of my chores on December 8th was to mop the parlor floor. And that's the time I heard President Roosevelt give his famous speech of, at war. A few of his sayings there, I do remember that speech and everything like that, yeah.
So when you hear that speech now, it takes you back to mopping the parlor floor?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Well, and you said something there. One of 13 in your family.
Yes, right.
11 boys and 2 girls. Yeah. And I got to rewind then a little bit, because I imagine the Depression years had to be pretty tough for a family of 13.
That's right. I remember my father, he worked as a carpenter for the Boston Elevated Railway at the time. And I don't know if he was making $41 a week at the time, supporting 13, plus him and my mother, too, you know. So I guess it was rough, but I never knew it about it or anything like that. But we always had food to eat, even though I was on the second setting. The first six ate before me, and I was in the last, because I'm second last in the family. And yet, I'm the sole survivor now. So
I don't want people to miss that. You had two shifts at dinner because there are only enough seats to feed half of you?
At the table, right, yeah.
Wow.
And my mother ate last.
Were your parents immigrants?
Yes. My mother was from Nova Scotia, and my father was from Wales. And they met in church in Boston. That's how they met and everything like that, yeah.
Did your father ever teach you any Welsh? Because that's a pretty interesting language.
No, I never, hardly ever heard him speak Welsh or anything like that. Yeah.
Those Gaelic languages are pretty wild.
Right, yeah.
You told me your Pearl Harbor memory. What was the development that led to you being involved in the war?
Well, I always wanted to be a pilot, and I always wanted to get into aviation, naval aviation especially. So when I turned 17, I went to the recruiting station, hoping to get into naval aviation. But I knew I was colorblind, and I tried to fake my way through it by listening to the guys in front of me, the numbers on the color chart. So I thought I had them well memorized, but when I get up there, the guy asked me, read the numbers. I said, okay, 25, 32, 75. So we wrote past. Then he says, wait a minute. Where do you see 25? Of course, I didn't see 25. I said, right there. And he said, and where do you see 36? But there was no 36 there. And I said, right there. So he turns the page over, and he says, now read them. And I couldn't read them. All I saw was dots and everything like that. So he said, no. He says, you can't get it. It's either the Army or the Seabees. So I didn't want the Army, and I wanted the Seabees because I know they'd be building airfields, and that's where all our planes would be and everything like that. And which that's the way it worked out. So I did take the Seabees. But after boot camp, the 1st Battalion was formed, and they attached us to the 5th Marine Division at Camp Lejeune. And of course, it was no construction work at all. It was all combat type of material, like machine guns, 20 millimeters, Bangalore torpedoes, and how to attack a tank. And that was all Marines, you know, all stuff. So we were there for 3 months, and then after about January of 44, we transferred to Camp Pendleton. Continued on the same thing of training with the Marines and everything like that. And then finally, for some strange reason, they pulled our battalion out and sent us to Maui, which was tough duty, you know. So the other battalion they put with the 5th Marine Division, they went to Iwo Jima, which if we didn't get pulled out, I would have ended up in Iwo Jima.
Wow.
But we were sent to Maui. What we do, we built up the Kahului Naval Air Station at the time. What it was a training station for carrier air groups. So the carrier would come into Pearl Harbor and the air group would fly over to Kahului. And they're trained there for about 3 weeks, all sorts of diving, combat, torpedo plane, and all that stuff. So that's where I got to really get along with the aircraft at the time. So I spent a lot of time with the guys who were in the casual outfits with the carrier aircraft service unit. And I got friendly with them, and I was running Hellcats and everything like that with my favorite airplane. But then after 6 months, a job finished there. Then they sent us to the Philippines, the island of Samar.
And that is where we'll pick up 99-year-old Pete Behenna's story when we come back from this final break. You can find Pete and the other veterans you've heard from today at the Palm Springs Air Museum, which is open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And kids 12 and under get in free with a paid adult. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. it's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode with some of the volunteers who bring the Palm Springs Air Museum to life every day. I want to send a big thank you to Ann Greer for her help in facilitating these interviews. And let's jump back in now with 99-year-old World War II veteran Pete Behenna, who as a teenage Navy Seabee helped build runways for planes like the ones he showcases now at the museum. He even has his name on one of them. More on that in a moment. But when we left off with Pete, he had been sent to the island of Samar in the Philippines.
So we went in there, knocked down all the palm trees, built a crush coral runway. We had B-24s from there bombing Borneo and Corsairs strafing and bombing Luzon area. And we had a lot, bunch of P-38s there too. And it was a busy place. We kept that field going, plus other projects too. And then when the war ended, being one of the younger guys there, we were sent up to North China, to Tenshin, China, where we worked with the Marines repatriating the Japanese back to Japan, who was still in China when the war ended. So we had to protect the Japanese from the Chinese for obvious reasons, because the Japanese were very brutal to the Chinese during the war and everything like that. So even us CBs, we had several skirmishes with the Chinese guerrillas who were trying to get at the Japanese and everything like that there. So it was a busy place, yeah.
Quite an adventure for a young man. And, yeah. You know, a couple things that I heard you say. You said you built a crushed coral runway there on Samar. I don't know too many people who have done that. Was that a challenge to get that nice and smooth?
No, it was like all the other Philippine airfield, Lady or something like that. They probably had to do the same thing. But some of them had to put in this, pierced plank. I forget what the heck it was called.
Was that the Marston matting?
Marston matting, exactly, yeah. But we didn't have to use that. We used the crushed coral runway. We crush it all up and lay it down in a long line, about 5,000 feet. But then it raised heck with the tires on the airplanes, you know, the coral did and everything like that. But as long as you wet it every night and rolled it down, it was hard as this concrete here and everything like that.
And were you operating cranes or tractors or what?
My job at first when I joined, as a 17-year-old, I didn't have any construction experience, so they had me work with the surveyors, you know, carrying their equipment and everything like that. Then after about a year or so, then I get into working to keep the machinery working, something like that. So when the guys that come along, they say, okay, we have to inspect this bulldozer. We've got this problem. It's wrong with it or something like that, so we need these parts here. So it was my job to go get the parts, order them, make sure we got them back, and so they get the machinery working properly and everything like that.
I know you have hundreds of docents here at the Palm Springs Air Museum, but I hear you kind of do the same thing around here. You're the parts guy who keeps things running?
Well, I was a docent for the first 10 years, you know, which is, I enjoy meet people from all over the world. They're very, very interesting. So finally, some guy donated a pinball machine that didn't work at all. So only but the kids are trying to come up and try to put money in it. They'd walk off very disgusted and discouraged and like that. So after what I said, hey, up front, I said, hey, can I take that home and work on it? Everything like that. So I did take the pinball machine home and work on it, got it working. But a lot of the inner parts of it were missing, like the diodes and capacitors and everything like that. I couldn't get it. And I also wanted the bell to ring. I was trying to get the bell to ring. But now I can work it where the ball goes up around and bounces around and everything like that. And the kids enjoy that. The mothers say the younger kids like that. So get that going. And finally, somebody brought in a jukebox. So the jukebox would work. Everyone, then all of a sudden it wouldn't or something like that. So they'd say, Pete, would you look at that? And I would, and the fellow who owns it, he loaned it to us. Every once in a while, he'll come down and show me different things, how to work it, how to, in fact, I got to lube it today, oil it today, and everything like that. And so I do that. And then I'm an A&P mechanic also for American Airlines. I went to, after the war, I went to Boston University, got my A&P license, took the course in aircraft maintenance and engineering, and got my A&P, and then I went to work for American Airlines in Boston. But the winters got to me, you know. After being in Camp Pendleton in January, February of 44, the weather was just like this, you know, 75 and 80. So working in Boston in the winter, the snow and the sleet and the rain got to me, so I said, heck, I'm transferring to L.A. So I transferred to here in 1960, and like that, and worked on a lot of the piston airplanes, right through to the jets and everything like that. So, but then when I came here, I said to the fellas, hey, you know, hey, I'm an A&P. I said, do you need any help? I said, I'd be glad to help you. Why don't they? And they said, yeah, okay. Well, they begged me to start up on their hardware system and O-ring system, because you know all the numbers, the ANs and NASs and all that numbers and all that. So I said, yeah, I'll do that too. So that's when, and then some small jobs I'll do, like replace a tail wheel or something, but no climbing. I said, no climbing at my age. So I remember they gave me my first job over there was change the plugs, clean them, gap them, put them back in on a P-63. So I did that, and it took me all day, and I said, hey, guys, hey, that's too much like work. I'll leave that to the guys who are getting paid, you know, so I was a volunteer. Yeah. So, but then, like when they have annual checks on them, I'll open the panels for them and close them and replace broken bonding wires and stuff like that, you know. So, but I enjoy doing that also.
What's that stack of nickels in your hand for?
That is to play the jukebox. Uh-huh. Yeah, so every morning I come over here. My first job is to see that they have enough docents here. And if they don't have enough docents, then I work as a docent. If they have enough docents, I come over here and check out the machines, make sure they work. And then after that, then I go over to maintenance and see if those guys need any help or ordering parts or parts that have come in. I tell them they're there and all that stuff like that. So, anyway.
And how long have you been volunteering here?
21 years, yeah. So it keeps me off the couch.
Off the couch and out of trouble.
Yeah. I'm always in trouble. I'm always in trouble. Yeah.
Thanks for setting the record straight. Well, I do have a question about the museum, but I want to take you back to World War II. So your time in the Pacific, were there times where you dealt with some of that real awful weather, the typhoons, or even enemy bombers, Bedcheck Charlie, anything like that?
No, we didn't have that. By the time we got there, it was pretty well cleared out. But our planes were going on bombing missions. Yeah, we had a lot of guys come back and, you know, crash land and everything. You know, a great junkyard there of airplanes, I'll tell you. But no, as I say, we were not in combat, but we were in a combat area. That's the way it is, yeah. So, but typhoons, boy, I'm telling you, there was one terrific one when we left Samar to go up to Tinsen. And on the way past Okinawa, we went through the tail end of a typhoon. I'm telling you, I never so sick in my life. For 5 days, I was sick. I mean, you just go up and see the shore, you see the sky. Then when you get down, you don't see sky. All you see is water. And another interesting thing about that trip, too, was we had a destroyer following us. Because during the war, the Air Force and the Navy mined all that area and everything like that, and a lot of mines. So our destroyer was going along looking for mines, setting in, and numerous ones we found, and we'd have to stop until they blew the mine up and everything like that. Even at night, when we're going along, the guys up in the crow's nest with searchlights going in front of us looking for the mines. That's about being seasick all that time. That was an experience also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sounds pretty nerve-wracking. Yeah. And I don't want to gloss over what you shared about China, because that's such a forgotten part of the war from an American perspective. You have exhibits here at the museum about the Flying Tigers, and people know about the China-Burma-India theater. Mm-hmm. But so after the war, you're going to safely escort Japanese soldiers out of China so the Chinese don't take revenge on them?
That's right. Exactly right, yeah.
And you said there were actually some skirmishes and firefights?
Skirmishes, yeah, with them, yeah. In fact, the guerrillas were going out and getting Chinese who participated with the Japanese. They were taking them back and shooting them and everything like that. And so But at night we had to go out because we were in a compound that was built by the Japanese during their occupation there, like a 10-foot wall, and then 3 foot above that was electrified barbed wire and like that. And what they used to do is throw rabbits and chickens up there to get us at night and everything like that to skirmish them and all that stuff, yeah. We had to be on our toes all the time, yeah.
I asked you about Pearl Harbor Day. What about VJ Day? You remember where you were when you heard it was all over?
Yes, yeah. We were on Samar at the time, and at the air base we were at, they were firing up all sorts of rockets and everything like that. It was just like seeing the fireworks at Disneyland or something like that. It was like that, but they were shooting off everything then. At I remember that night there watching them, yeah. Then our guys, I see them dancing in the compound area and all that stuff, yeah. So night I'll never forget, yeah. So it was good, yeah.
Well, another question I realized I need to ask you, because you told us you're one of 13 children in your family.
Yeah.
How many of your siblings ended up in the war?
There were six of us.
Wow.
The five boys and my daughter, my sister, was in the WACS at the time, too.
Wow.
There was three of us in the Navy and two in the Army. One of my brothers, he was in the Tank Destroyer Battalion in Europe, attached to Patton's group and everything like that. And he participated in the Bulge and everything like that. He came out and told us all about that and all that, yeah. Then I had two brothers. One was 4F. He couldn't get in. He had a punctured eardrum. Then my other brother was a religious teacher. It was busy. It was busy.
And you all made it home?
We all made it home, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that one of those things where the stereotype is the mother's on her knees praying for all of you every night?
I would think so. But see, as a kid growing up in a family of 13, you know, you don't get the love that you would get if you were one or two kids or something like that, you know.
Sure.
So I remember my father, when I first came in after that time, he didn't know I was coming home because I didn't even call. But all he looked at me and shook my hand and everything like that. And it's the first time my mother kissed me.
Wow.
Yeah, so I say we had so many kids in the house that she was busy enough keeping the house clean and doing the cooking. Yeah, yeah.
So the day you came home from World War II was the first time your mother kissed you?
Yes. After 2 years, yeah. We were gone for 2 years, yeah.
You say you've been volunteering here for over 20 years.
Yeah.
I imagine when you started, there were probably quite a few World War II veterans who were volunteering here?
Yes, there were. There were, yeah. Mm-hmm. Quite a few. And it's usually, they say they're losing about 1,000 a day or something like that. So I just keep my fingers crossed, you know, from day to day. You never know.
Are you the last one here?
No, I think... Well, they have one guy who's older than me. He's 100 years old.
Uh-huh.
But he's not participating as much as, like, we had, let me see, Charlie Pettit in the gift shop. He was there for a number of years. He was a year older than I was. Yeah, he was in anti-aircraft. But he's since retired from here also, yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
I guess I have to ask how long you're going to keep doing this.
Keep my fingers crossed. Yeah.
One day at a time?
One day at a time, yeah. Just have to hope that I enjoy it. I look forward to coming here and I look forward to meeting all the people from all around the world. Then they come to watch this here stuff, you know?
Yeah, we're sitting here in front of the little Bob Hope Theater and the USO, so many shows. You never saw him during the war, did you?
Yes, I did.
You did?
I saw him in Maui, which was very good. And of course, in fact, we had a picture before the movies here. They had a stage here of the South Pacific. All the sailors and soldiers standing around, and him up there. See this girl over here with a short thing dancing? Her name is Patty Thomas. She was one of his entertainers, like along with Francis Langford and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And I saw Betty Hutton, too, at the time. But we were there with a funny joke. He would take her out in front of the audience the way she is and hold her hand, and he'd look around and he'd say, "Fellas, this is what you're fighting for." They all cheered, yay, scream, yeah, okay. And then they did a little skit where he takes her hand out in front of the officer, and he looks up in the sky, pretends he's putting a make on, you know. So he's looking up in the sky at night, and he says, "Oh, look at that moon, isn't that beautiful?" "Yeah, that's okay." And then, "Oh, look at those stars, aren't they romantic?" "Okay." Then he looks down, "Oh, some do." She says, "Yeah, but I don't," like that. So, but anyway... I had told that joke to Marines who were in Vietnam. And he said, "Well, Bob Hope told us the same story in Vietnam, but he had Raquel Welch with him and everything like that." So it was quite funny, yeah.
And have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
No, I haven't. I would like to go sometime, and see that, but I never, I've been there 40 or 50 years ago, and one of the memorials I liked was the Iwo Jima Memorial. I liked that one there. That was very good. And also, I remember I went on a veterans cruise one year out of, I was up in, living up in Paradise for a while. Went out there, it was a good World War II cruise, leaving from Honolulu to, Midway, Guadalcanal, Saipan, Tinian, Guam, Okinawa, into Hiroshima. Well, that was a very, very interesting cruise, World War II cruise, yeah.
Would you let us take you there on one of our honor flights? Could you miss a Monday through Wednesday here at the museum to go to D.C.?
Yes. I have to talk to my daughters first. I lost my wife about 10 years ago. And so I live alone in Desert Hot Springs here. Usually they watch me like a hawk, you know, and everything like that.
Well, one of them could go as your guardian.
Yeah, I think my daughter would like that, yeah.
We could even do it in April before you turn 100.
Yeah. If I'm still here, you know. So we'll have to see, yeah.
Well, Pete, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for your example here at the museum. If someone comes to the museum, what's one thing they absolutely have to see?
My name on the side of the Hellcat. That's a joke. When I came here, like in the Navy, the pilots would have their name on the fuselage, and then below that they'd have the name of a listed man who was their plane captain. And and so all the time I was here, I would say to him, I'd like to have my name on the side of the Hellcat. I was afraid some other guy, like in restoration or something like that, would say, put his name on it. I want that reserved for me, because that would be special, very special for me. So, you know, that's my idea. I'm proud of having my name on that. It's the name of the naval pilot who shot down more Japanese planes in World War II, David McCampbell. So to be on the same side of the fuselage with his name is quite an honor and everything like that. You know, everything here is good, like this airplane right here. Now, I was involved in air racing. Me and a couple of other guys helped restore a bear cat for racing called the Rare Bear. Never like that. We did that in 69. From a wreck, we built it up. Now it's the fastest propeller-driven airplane in the world and all that stuff, yeah. So that was one of the highlights of my life also, working on that too, yeah. So
let me ask you this, Pete, because you're closing in on that 100th birthday. That's a lot of life to take stock of. When you think back on it all, is there something you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, my family, my mother and father, I'm proud of them. Then being in the service was one of the highlights of my life. I always remember. And then working here, I enjoy this here. That's why I didn't even get out of a sick bed to come here, but not to pass any germs or anything like that. But I enjoy it so much. I mean, just meeting all the people, and the people who run the place are very good too. So it's a great time.
And Pete Behenna would love to meet you one of these days at the Palm Springs Air Museum, where he was one of the gala honorees last year at the museum's biggest annual event. February 7th is the date for the 2026 gala, which is black tie or military uniform for the dress. Actor Joe Mantegna will be the celebrity MC, and the theme this year is Vietnam, honoring character, remembering courage. You can book your tickets at palmspringsairmuseum.org, and I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time, but thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.